Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. Our guest on this episode is David J. Morris, a war correspondent, former Marine, and PTSD sufferer. Morris's new book is The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. Morris served as a lieutenant in the Marine Corps in the 1990s, but did not see combat then. He went on to work as an embedded journalist in Iraq and Afghanistan. In 2004, he was nearly killed when a Humvee he was riding in was hit by an IED. In World War I, soldiers suffering from so-called shell shock were often treated as cowards, charged with desertion, and sometimes executed. Treatment, if it was offered, was harsh, often involving electric shock therapy. PTSD was first recognized officially in 1980, due in part to the activism of Vietnam War veterans. People who suffer from PTSD often relive a traumatic experience through nightmares and flashbacks, have difficulty sleeping, and feel detached or estranged. Their symptoms can be severe enough and last long enough to significantly impair their daily life. The Department of Veterans Affairs reports that 5.2 million American adults have PTSD during a given year. About 10% of women develop PTSD sometime in their lives, compared with about 4% of men. When David J. Morris returned home for treatment, he discovered that many VA workers seem to lack a thorough understanding of PTSD. He set out to research in great detail the causes and treatment of the syndrome. His work includes scientific, historical, and literary research and interviews with people living with PTSD. Morris found people in the U.S. largely unsympathetic to the plight of sufferers. In The Evil Hours, he writes, "No other people in history is as disconnected from the brutality of war as the United States today." The Elliott Bay Book Company presented this reading and talk on February 13, 2015. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for this recording.
As he takes down the stage that he's trying to mount, thanks for coming, guys. I know it's not a school night, so we appreciate. Friday evening is some heavy emotional real estate on the calendar to come out and hear dark stuff about PTSD. It is kind of a dark subject. I actually just had, am I okay sound-wise? Okay. I actually just had coffee with a retired Army Special Forces officer who is sort of locally famous, or not locally, he's famous within sort of Army circles and Washington circles, and it was really interesting to see somebody, you know, having coffee with somebody, and we were just around the corner at Stumptown, and then it was loud in the room, and it was hard, and he didn't, you know, we changed seats so that he didn't have his back to the door, so it was a good, and not to mention this guy had a service record, you know, second to none. Some people called him like the Lawrence of Afghanistan, like Lawrence of Arabia, but in Afghanistan. So he was a very real notable figure. So it was a real honor to be in front, you know, to have an audience with that sort of person. And then to also just see how, you know, clearly he was struggling, you know, was pretty obviously struggling with post-traumatic stress. And so it's good to, I wrote this book over the course of a number of years, and so you don't always, it takes a while. There's sort of writing a book is kind of this, like yelling into a really, really large cathedral or a cave, and it takes a really long time for the echo to come back. And so this was one case where I got to hear the echo, like really, you know, it was a good and interesting way to kind of have that echo come back to you, which I appreciated. So what I wanted to do, I'll read briefly for about 10, 15 minutes, and then we'll take some questions. I'd like to hear questions from you guys and your response to what I'm reading and to the work itself. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to explain briefly some of the reasons that I went to Iraq and kept going there was to sort of get an impression of the deeper experience of the war. and my feeling that there was some sort of deeper reality that could be touched or experienced by going to a conflict zone. So this first couple pages kind of address that impulse and why I, what some of the reasons I chose to go to the war. Thank you. So this is from the prologue of the book called The Warning. Have you ever been blown up before, sir? Everything was fine until it wasn't. Apophenia, finding patterns where there shouldn't be patterns. These were the words I wrote in my journal on October 9th, 2007, the day before I was almost killed by a roadside bomb in Baghdad. The last line I wrote in the days afterwards. Later, I went back and underlined them in a different colored ink as if to emphasize that I had come back to it in a different state of mind, as if I were leaving a clue for some future version of myself. I was in Iraq for my third reporting trip and had gone out on a patrol with some soldiers from the 1st Infantry Division into Sidiya, a neighborhood that seemed, at least on the surface, to be relatively peaceful. On our way back inside the wire, one of the soldiers asked nonchalantly if I'd ever been blown up before. I considered the question for a moment, and then, as the silence deepened, I sensed that something was amiss. The words came awkwardly as I explained that while I had spent the summer before in Ramadi, at that point the deadliest city in Iraq, I was still a virgin in that particular area. However, it was like my fate had been spoken. I had never been blown up before, but everyone in the Humvee knew that was about to change. According to the laws of grunt superstition, I was the injured party, but somehow I managed to feel bad for the kid who'd asked the question. As it happened, the soldiers in the Humvee were from all over Latin America, Peru, Mexico, Guatemala, and they began pummeling him in a variety of languages and accents for what he'd done. At the time, I felt embarrassed more than anything else and just wanted the moment to end. I didn't like being the topic of conversation, and I took everything I had to avoid thinking about being blown into tiny red pieces. This, in fact, is one of the first head tricks I'd learned in Iraq, one of the first head tricks that everyone learned in Iraq, to systematically ignore the obvious. You were always just about to die. Get over it. I was wasted, too, and my mind wasn't right. I had been in Iraq for a total of 9 months at this point, and even though I'd seen people killed by roadside bombs, I'd never been hit myself, and somehow I'd come to feel that I'd had my luck under control. But in posing this question, it was as if the soldier had stolen that control, thrown me over to the forces of chance that I had worked so hard to insulate myself from. Later, I interviewed a prominent psychoanalyst who told me that trauma, in fact, destroys the fabric of time. In normal time, you move from one moment to the next, from sunrise to sunset, birth to death. After trauma, you may move in circles, find yourself being sucked backwards into an eddy, bouncing about like a rubber ball from now to then and back again. August is June. June is December. What time is it? Guess again. In the traumatic universe, the basic laws of matter are suspended. Ceiling fans can be helicopters. Car exhaust can be mustard gas. Another odd feature of traumatic time is that it doesn't just destroy the flow of the present into the future. It corrodes everything that came before, eating at moments and people from your previous life until you can't remember why any of them mattered. What I previously found inconceivable is now inescapable. I have been blown up so many times in my mind that it is impossible to imagine a version of myself that has never been blown up. The man on the other side of the soldier's question is not me. In fact, he has never existed. The war is gone now, but the event remains. The happening that nearly erased the life to come and thus erased the life that came before. The soldier's question hangs in the air the way it always has, the way it always will. Have you ever been blown up before, sir? So I thought I would to sort of give a broader picture of the larger questions of PTSD. This book I designed. Took a long time to come up with a narrative design for it because post-traumatic stress disorder is such a confounding and confusing kind of junk drawer of symptoms as it's described in the media. And so one thing I try to do, like with those first pages, is get really close and look for the interior emotional architecture of it and try to illuminate it from inside without, from within to without. And then also talk to other trauma survivors and war veterans and rape victims and see what commonalities we might have between our stories and our experiences. And then in contrast to the very close in, I also wanted to step back as far away as I could and still be on the planet and kind of examine the larger scientific issues and epidemiological issues and the cultural issues and the literary issues and the cinematic issues that all kind of inform how we conceptualize and how we think of PTSD and how it lives as a being within the culture. I mean, the book is sort of an odd, unusual, divergent literary idea in the sense that I'm writing, it's called a biography of PTSD, and I'm writing about a mental health condition as if it is a person. So I wanted to sort of take that idea and consider where it was born, its influences, how it came of age, and what it was that actually influenced this person and where this person might be going. So this is the introduction. It's about 10 pages worth, and then we'll get to some questions. Introduction. Over the past four decades, post-traumatic stress disorder has permeated every corner of our culture. A condition that went unacknowledged for millennia and began its public life with a handful of disgruntled Vietnam veterans rapping in the offices of an anti-war group in Midtown Manhattan in December 1970 has now spread to every nation on the globe, becoming, in the words of one medical anthropologist, a kind of, quote, psychiatric Esperanto, end quote. A species of pain that went unnamed for most of human history, PTSD is now the fourth most common psychiatric disorder in the United States. According to the latest estimates, nearly 8% of all Americans, 28 million people, will suffer from post-traumatic stress at one point in their lives. According to the Veterans Administration, which spends more annually on PTSD research and treatment than any organization in the world, PTSD is the number one health concern of American military veterans, regardless of when or where they served. In 2010, the federal government spent $3 billion on PTSD treatment for veterans, a figure that doesn't even include the nearly $4 billion in PTSD disability payments made every year to former service members. Since the attacks of 9/11, when public awareness of the disorder gained momentum, PTSD, a condition characterized by hyperarousal, emotional numbing, and recurring flashbacks, has, to the dismay of some international aid experts, supplanted hunger as the primary Western public health concern when a war or other humanitarian crisis hits the news. PTSD is one of the newest major psychiatric disorders to be recognized, and yet today it has entered the public lexicon to the degree that it is not uncommon to hear journalists describing entire countries as being stricken with it and writing lengthy articles debating whether Batman or Katniss Everdeen might be suffering from it. Consumers who are so inclined can now go online and purchase a commemorative patch for $5.99 that reads, PTSD, not all wounds are visible. As any trauma researcher will tell you today, PTSD is everywhere. And yet, like many mental health disorders, there is broad disagreement about what PTSD is exactly, who gets it, and how best to treat it. There remains a small but vocal cadre of researchers who argue that PTSD is, in fact, a social fiction, a relic of the Vietnam War era, foisted upon the global community by well-meaning but misguided clinicians, and that by, in essence, encouraging people to be traumatized, we undermine their recovery. A condition born of strife, PTSD is dominated by conflict in its scientific life as well. There is, however, little disagreement that survivors of rape, war, natural disaster, and torture, the events that are generally recognized to lead to PTSD, experience profound, even existential pain in the aftermath of such events. This brand of suffering has become so widely recognized that it has, in fact, permanently altered the moral compass of the Western world and changed our understanding of what it means to be human, what it means to feel pain. Pierre Genet, a French neurologist writing in 1925, observed that emotional reactions to traumatic events can be so intense as to, quote, have a disintegrating effect on the entire psychological system. This book is about that effect and what it looks like and feels like from the inside. Over time, PTSD has changed not only the way humans understand loss, but how humans understand themselves generally. I am interested in it both as a mental condition and as a metaphor. How people respond to horror has always been determined by a complex web of social, political, and technological forces. For most of human history, interpreting trauma has been the preserve of artists, poets, and shamans. The ways in which a nation deals with trauma are revealing as its politics and its language. The ancient Greeks, for their part, staged plays that were written and performed by war veterans as a communal method for achieving catharsis. Today, for better or for worse, we deal with trauma and horror almost exclusively through a complex, seemingly arbitrary cluster of symptoms known as post-traumatic stress disorder. In the classical world, the ancients in the wake of trauma might look for answers in epic poetry such as the Iliad or the Odyssey. Today, we turn to the most current edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. This fact alone is worthy of further exploration. Most of us no longer turn to poetry, our families, or the clergy for solace post-horror. Instead, we turn to psychiatrists. This is, historically speaking, an extremely unusual state of affairs. Before 2011, I had never seriously considered the question of post-traumatic stress, either in myself or as a general subject. I returned home in 2007 as I had returned home from all my reporting trips to Iraq, with a powerful feeling of alienation from my countrymen. Freshly deplaned for what I understood to be the defining event of my generation, I discovered to my great surprise that no one back home held this view or seemed to have given much thought to the war at all. Like Nick Carraway returning home from the East in The Great Gatsby, I came home expecting to find the world at a, quote, sort of moral attention, end quote. When this didn't happen, I was disappointed. The war had changed me, enlarged me in some way, made me feel as if history were a tangible force in my life. And seeing the workaday world, people with their looks of practiced oblivion, put me on edge. The writer in me secretly wished for something similar to what had happened before, perhaps something out of the Vietnam era. People marching in the streets, students debating the war's meaning on college campuses, the war making itself felt at home in some visible way, the loss given some physical form. The war had hurt me. I wanted the country to feel some of that hurt. Part of me needed to see that, to remind me that the war had been real, not just something I saw when I closed my eyes. I needed to know that the experience had meaning and that the death I had seen really mattered. What I saw instead were people commuting to work and going to the mall, the gym, and the health food store, making their bodies perfect, exactly as they had before. The yellow ribbons I saw seemed almost like a taunt, a challenge to all the horror I'd witnessed. I learned very quickly that talking about the war wasn't just pointless, but actually damaging in its own right. I could barely begin to describe what I had seen before I'd be interrupted by a racist comment about Arabs, or by someone stopping me to explain that the war had really been about oil all along, and that the important thing, really, was to develop some alternative energy so that we could divest from the Middle East altogether. After a while, I realized that the problem wasn't just that they didn't understand the war, but that they didn't want to understand it. What I had to say was not only inconvenient to their peace of mind, but a tangible threat to it. Americans could no more cope with the reality of the war than they could cope with the reality of particle physics. Not only was it beyond their ken, but the fact that it might be beyond their ken was beyond their ken. Trying to cut through the various layers of incomprehension, I was confronted by further obscenities. If by some chance I could get someone to listen to me about what I had seen in Iraq, they would end up looking at me like I had some sort of speech impediment. They'd meet my eyes, and I'd get the look, a sort of mirror image of the famous 10,000-yard stare from World War II, a look that told me more about American innocence than I ever wanted to know. More than once, I was asked if I'd kill anyone over there. At times, my sense of alienation grew so strong that I seemed almost radiant with it, as if a stranger could look at me and tell that something was wrong. Sometimes I would start to shake when I thought about the war, how wrong it was, how many childish mistakes had been made, how no one in power had been held accountable, and how tens of thousands have died in the service of some Beltway egos. Or the people who had died in the service of nothing at all, owing to the simplest accidents of time and space. One unit I was with north of Fallujah had lost a guy who was killed while using a port-a-john in the middle of the night. He'd gone out to take a shit, and out of nowhere, a single mortar round came in and ended him. It was the only incoming they'd taken in days. How do you go about telling a guy who is alive only because he didn't use the crapper at the wrong time that he ought to go back home, go to school, get married and mortgaged, have kids, and commit to the world when he knows for a fact that nothing in the world is real except chance? That his continued existence, his dreams, his plans, his hopes for the future are products of invisible odds, ever-changing odds, odds that could shift and turn on him at any moment. What place did human reason have in this world, really, when you'd seen what the war could do to it? The lesson taught by the war was clear. To be human is to be small, powerless, and subject to the forces of randomness. Every veteran knows this. Every trauma survivor knows this. Knowing this is what makes it hard to step onto airplanes. Knowing this is what makes it hard to stand in large crowds. Knowing this is what makes it hard to drive a car. Quote, the war itself was a mystery. Nobody knew what it was about, or why they were there, or who started it, or who was winning, or how it might end. Secrets were everywhere. Booby traps in the hedgerows, bouncing Bettys under the red clay soil, and the people, the silent papasans, the hollow-eyed children, and the jabbering old women. What did these people want? What did they feel? So wrote Tim O'Brien in his novel In the Lake of the Woods, a book that traces the aftermath of the Vietnam War, the flashbacks of a traumatized veteran. Still, at other times, I found myself in pain, missing the field, missing the Marines and the excitement, the profane beauty of their words, the mid-patrol trance I'd slip into, the bump and grind of enemy contact, the feelings I'd had in a place where every second could either save you or kill you, where even the smallest gesture took on a certain weight because you knew it might be your last. Instead, people back home just looked at me as if there were something wrong with me, a look that cost me nothing to return. That these two worlds, the world of war and the world of home, could be kept so isolated, one living in almost perfect ignorance of the other, was an obscenity surpassed only by the obscenity of the war itself. The war had been difficult, but there seemed to be some meaning in having survived it. Coming home and feeling the dullness of the people, the pride they took in their ignorance, seemed to diminish that meaning, as if it had only been a bad backpacking trip overseas that I'd come back from. How could this be allowed to happen, I wondered. Could a war really be called a war if no one back home gave a crap about it? In time, I resolved to hate the country I'd once served, the fat, sheltered land with its surplus of riches, its helicopter moms, its real estate agents. Narrow-minded, smug, and only dimly aware of other lives other than their own. Virtually every survivor of trauma, whether or not they experience post-traumatic stress, returns to the regular world and quickly recognizes that things are not as they once were. People behave differently. There is an element of strangeness, a sense, often uncommunicated, of being marked by a kind of scarlet letter, even if one has not violated any moral code. In fact, in these situations, one's degree of innocence or complicity in events can seem almost beside the point, as if one's luck or simple fate is what's actually at stake. Often, this change of perception is expressed in physical or spatial terms, as if the scope of what has transpired is so vast that it serves to alter one's material position in the world. One British World War I veteran described his post-war experience as one lived in a, quote, mental internment camp, unquote. Alice Siebold, in her best-selling memoir, Lucky, which describes the aftermath of her rape at age 19, looked out at the faces of her college classmates less than an hour after she had been raped and saw that, quote, she was on the other side of something, they could not understand. I didn't understand it myself, end quote. This palpable sense of not belonging, of being, quote, on the other side of something after trauma, has in fact been widely noted. Anthropologists who study tribal societies describe this state as one of liminality, which comes from the Latin word for threshold. Arnold Van Gennep coined the term in his 1908 book, Rites of Passage, that draws on his studies of the tribes of southwestern Africa. The liminal state, as observed by Van Gennep, is thought to be, quote, dangerous and precarious, end quote, because of its social ambiguity and the conflicting paradoxical demands it places on the individual, on both the individual and on the society to which they belong. In tribal society, liminal states such as adolescence were punctuated by ceremonies designed to accompany, to quote, accompany a passage from one situation to another or from one cosmic or social world to another. Weddings, graduations, bar mitzvahs, and quinceañeras are all examples of Van Gennepian rites of passage, which end dramatically and decisively with the person's new status being made clear to the community. Yet, as Victor Turner, an influential anthropologist, pointed out, the modern world has no such rites of incorporation, end quote, to mark the transition from the underworld of trauma to the everyday world, saying, quote, the liminal person, in this case the returning veteran, is not alive, not dead, both somehow and neither, end quote. Unexpectedly alone and unsure what world I was in, I began tentatively, even skeptically, to explore the idea of post-traumatic stress, first as a historical entity and then once again on more personal terms. Had I really been traumatized, I wondered? I had paid almost nothing as these things went. Sure, I had nightmares and felt haunted by the past, but who didn't? PTSD? Wasn't that something that homeless Vietnam vets had? I'd spent some time in Dora and Fallujah, been blown up and shot at a number of times, but I knew plenty of people who'd seen far worse things than I had. However, as I would learn, one of the deceptive things about trauma is that it is usually pretty easy to find someone who has been through something more awful than what you've been through, and thus dismiss your pain, endlessly prolonging the process. It's always easy to find people to place at the top of the pyramid of loss: Holocaust survivors, Bosnian refugees, African child soldiers. But what about all that space below them? Who goes there? Who decides? It reminded me of something a veteran in the Battle of Kafji once said to me, a guy who'd lost 11 of his buddies to friendly fire. Quote, it was bad, but it wasn't like Stalingrad or anything. As a Marine lieutenant, I'd always been told in times of uncertainty to go to the library, to read, to get smart, to not reinvent the wheel. Look at the history. It's likely that someone before you has faced the same challenges that you face now. So I went to the largest library within a day's drive of my house, in this case, the University of California, San Diego, and began methodically working my way through the stacks. What I found was surprising. PTSD may well be the Esperanto of psychiatry, but its research literature is remarkably chaotic. Taken at a distance, the world of trauma resembles an arcade at the state fair. Along one side was a series of stalls populated by psychiatrists, psychologists, and neuroscientists, and along the other side were poets, memoirists, historians, and anthropologists. The barkers within each stall might call out to you, singing the virtues of their worldview, but there seemed to be little overlap between these various groups, let alone coherence. The result was a wash of statistics and anecdotes that offered no logical point of entry for the common observer. As I would learn, PTSD, as it is understood today, is a very heterogeneous disease, essentially a junk drawer of disconnected symptoms, which include a numbing of the emotions, hypervigilance or always being amped up, social isolation, and a variety of intrusive symptoms, such as nightmares and hallucinations. The field of trauma studies embodies this fragmentation, with each subspecies of researcher rarely poking their head out of their own little stall, to continue the state fair metaphor. This sort of siloing of expertise is common throughout academia. But with the problem of trauma, it is unusually counterproductive because, as Jonathan Shea, a pioneering trauma theorist, likes to point out, quote, trauma impacts the whole critter, by which he means it impacts every aspect of a person's life. In the months that followed, I would enter therapy at the VA, take part in 3 research studies, visit 3 historical archives, and interview scores of researchers from across the country, looking for an answer to one question: what is PTSD? The more I looked, the more I found my initial impression held true. Mental health is an unusually demanding and at times confounding line of work, but I was astonished to learn that few clinicians were familiar with the literature of the Vietnam War, from which PTSD emerged, nor did they possess an even rudimentary understanding of the global war on terror. One leading VA researcher I spoke to didn't seem to know where Fallujah was, nor, as I learned, had she ever read any of the work of Tim O'Brien. Similarly, many of the leading historians in the subject remain willfully ignorant and in some cases openly dismissive of the neuroscientific research relating to post-traumatic stress. One British author of an influential history of military psychiatry went so far as to brush off the neuroscience behind modern trauma studies as, quote, completely dubious. This lack of synthesis also struck me as odd because, apart from my own personal difficulties, I began to see that much as shell shock, a sort of precursor to PTSD, dominated the post-World War I imagination in Great Britain, so the phenomenon of PTSD dominates our culture today. As a cultural meme, PTSD is everywhere now, an inescapable part of our historical moment. As an expression of deeper anxieties, it defines our era in a way not unlike female hysteria defined late 19th century Europe, a reality that was not lost on many of Freud's contemporaries. As Otto Fennekel, one of Freud's protégés, put it once, neuroses do not occur out of biological necessity like aging. Neuroses are social diseases corresponding to a given and historically developed social milieu. They cannot be changed without a corresponding change in that milieu. It would be foolish to diagnose an entire nation with a mental health disorder, but as Susan Faludi points out in her 2007 book, The Terror Dream, Fear and Fantasy in Post-9/11 America, the country as a whole continues to exhibit certain aspects of post-traumatic stress, including a compulsion to reenact the events of September the 11th, in movies and television, as well as nurturing obsessions with homeland security and surveillance that, according to many military analysts, is way out of proportion with the actual threat and smacks of a kind of national hypervigilance. Moreover, the ongoing militarization of American culture in the form of first-person shooter video games, the rise of the Navy SEAL brand in books, films, and other media, and martially themed endurance races like the Tough Mudder and Spartan race series all point to a fixation with the post-9/11 hypermasculinity and ubiquitous violence that is reminiscent of the disorder. In a related vein, some observers have even drawn a connection between 9/11 and the recent helicopter parenting phenomenon, our overweening desire to protect our children from every conceivable danger to the point where we isolate them from the world and prevent them from ever having experiences that previous generations took for granted. Others point to the rising popularity of zombies in books and films as being symptomatic of a kind of paranoid, quote, cultural PTSD, in that zombies are like terrorists and they look like us, but they have been tainted by death and can seemingly strike anywhere at any time, or so the thinking goes. Indeed, one can quite easily construct an entire theory of recent American culture using PTSD as a nucleus, all without mentioning the tens of thousands of veterans and their families who suffer from post-traumatic stress, or the millions of rape victims who live every day amped up, numbed out, and generally haunted. PTSD has become a bit like Prozac in the 1990s. If you hear about it once, you hear about it 1,000 times. We live now in an aftermath culture, a culture where being traumatized is presumed to be the only appropriate response to any overwhelming situation. Quote, "These are the days after. Everything now is measured by the after," a character in Don DeLillo's 9/11 novel Falling Man says. This leads to the bigger questions. Why now? Why in the United States, a country that is, by any standard, one of the least traumatized on the planet? Is there something about the war on terror, a war that directly involves less than 1% of us, that has made us all a little nuts? Is there something about the larger war against Islamic extremism that has made us fear the outside world? If war is a kind of symbolic violence, then is PTSD a kind of symbolic penance? Do we so easily embrace the diagnosis out of a sort of white guilt about not having served ourselves overseas, as some have suggested? Or are PTSD and the threat of it simply another example of how modern therapeutic culture has forced its way into our daily lives and taught us how to perceive normal human adversity? In trying to address these questions and balance the various academic disciplines that inform our understanding of PTSD, these pages may display a bias towards literature. Part of this is simply the result of my being a writer, but there is also the fact that for the bulk of human history, literature has been the primary repository of knowledge about war, famine, genocide, and natural disaster. From the Iliad to the Great War poets to the literature of the Vietnam War, writers have been wrestling, and wrestling quite well, I might add, with the mysteries of trauma. In a sense, nothing has changed, and today's trauma survivors can take great comfort in knowing that they are confronting the same horrors that Achilles faced 4,000 years ago. Moreover, as practically any therapist will tell you, many of the long-term effects of trauma are the product of the emotional interpretation of events by survivors, interpretations that are informed by archetypal narratives that exist within a given culture, a process that is explicitly literary. As Robert Stolarow, an influential psychoanalyst, suggests, quote, "The experience of drama is context-dependent, meaning its essence lies in the subjective experience of the victim. In other words, their story as they tell it to themselves." By reading the stories of Hemingway, Alice Siebold, Tim O'Brien, and others, survivors are doing more than simply being entertained. They are reifying literature's essential function, that of reminding us that we are not alone, and in the process demonstrating how trauma was processed by previous generations. Medicine itself is founded upon a kind of storytelling. Siddhartha Mukherjee, in his biography of cancer, the title of which is The Emperor of All Maladies, explains that, quote, "Patients tell stories to describe illness. Doctors tell stories to understand it. Science tells its own story to explain such diseases." A number of the trauma workers I spoke to over the course of writing this book called my attention to this point, namely that part of trauma's corrosive power lies in its ability to actually destroy narrative, and that stories, written and spoken, have tremendous healing power, both for the teller and for the listener. Stories in the form of literature help us to understand the enigma of survival in a way that no other technology can. In short, literature makes meaning out of chaos. One senior VA psychiatrist I spoke to who has treated PTSD for over 30 years went so far as to say that, quote, "The central image of post-traumatic stress is that of Ishmael at the end of Moby Dick, floating atop Queequeg's coffin, looking out over the vastness of the sea." So I'd be happy to take whatever questions you might have. Yes, sir.
So I've got a series of questions for you. Nobody else does.
Hit me.
You mentioned the Iliad, and of course, Achilles, when in the Pope translation starts out, I sing the song of the wrath of Achilles. And my question is an act of bravery perhaps part of the trauma that works in certain instances?
It sounds like you know the Iliad far better than I do, to be frank. So the question is, can an act of bravery be a part of the trauma too?
How many acts of bravery are prompted as a response to a very severe trauma that frequently involves the loss of a friend, a close friend? That's what happens in the Iliad.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened to Daniel and Henry in Italy when he got the Medal of Honor for his act. And he acted in a way that he says he can't explain as totally irrational. But it was a brave act because he stood up and pointed at a German machine gun and fired his weapon and then had a bullet hit his arm and then took out a second machine gun nest with a grenade, throwing it with his left hand because his right arm was already damaged. I mean, that's all irrational.
Right. I guess it's, if I'm hearing you correctly, I think your question is, what role does human agency and human initiative and and bravery play in the role of trauma. Sure, sure. I mean, it's trauma as it's conceptualized by researchers, and I agree with them, is the totality of a particular situation. And one of the major factors that researchers think contributes to who gets PTSD and who doesn't is the role of how helpless or how much agency, how much power to act a person has in a given situation. And in the book, I'll try to answer your question as directly as I can with respect to, you know, these questions of valor and bravery, which are, I think we can agree, somewhat loaded terms. They are difficult sometimes to parse out, and there are different definitions of what bravery is.
I'm not trying to take anything away from the word bravery.
Right, right. And in the book, I examine in trying to explore who ends up with diagnosable PTSD and who does not. I looked at the Hanoi Hilton cohort, the cohort of prisoners of war from Vietnam that John McCain belonged to. And those group of people, most everyone can agree, demonstrated great bravery and valor under very extreme circumstances. And in that case, their ability to, and Admiral James Stockdale was one of the leaders of the Hanoi Hilton at that time, they developed a culture that emphasized teamwork and a belongingness and a spiritual transcendence and encouragement and a sense of optimism in that group. And many of the people they've interviewed after they were repatriated and returned to the U.S. described that actually 60% of the Air Force veterans that were incarcerated described it as a positive experience, that it had a spiritual power for them. And so that in that instance, I think that's an example of where really a lot of positive attributes and positive growth experiences did develop out of a really extreme situation. And I use that example in the book for a variety of reasons, you know, one of which is that it tends to be a pretty well-known historical episode, and almost everyone knows about John McCain and what he went through, and it's been reported a lot. And that group as well has a really, 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 really low PTSD, lifetime PTSD diagnosis rate. It's about 4%. Which is a fraction of what it is for today, which is a fraction of what it was for the Vietnam generation as a whole, which is often rated at about 30%. And that 4% figure is also a fraction of the current PTSD diagnosis rate among Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, which hovers between 12 to 15 to 17%. So I think that answers your question in terms of like how bravery and valor can sort of, how it sort of factors into the whole constellation of emotions and possible responses. Is there a question?
You were talking mainly, partly because you're discussing war and stuff, but you're discussing mainly adults facing PTSD or trauma. Does your book
Went
into children, things like child abuse over time, and the ways that children kind of develop that?
In a word, no. This is why. I deliberately excluded that from the narrative for the following reason. Child abuse and childhood trauma is as common and as powerful as it is, is considered by most researchers to sort of belong to its own world and adhere to a different set of laws. And so as I described in the book, the world of trauma studies is really separated and not coherent and is composed of all of this heap of literature that is not really very well sorted. And one of the things I wanted to do with the book was open the door and kind of create a smaller house that you could, you know, for to use a tricky metaphor, to have a smaller house that you could kind of walk within and explore with some sense of coherence. And so that required sort of, you know, locking off the basement and different parts of that, you know, metaphoric house in order to keep things a little bit simpler and keep the narrative a little bit more coherent. And I started to write some other stuff about childhood abuse and other aspects of more emerging fields of trauma research, like traumatic childbirth, PTSD arising from adverse surgeries and other areas that are just now being explored, and the narrative kind of got bogged down in a lot of asterisks and different, you know, different qualifications to different assertions. And I was trying, I mean, I, the book was really an exploration for me. I mean, a lot of it was the beginning of my interest really sort of centered on what it was that was happening in the 1970s. When Vietnam vets first came back and people were, for the first time in history, kind of examining and accepting the idea that there might be long-term psychological impacts from war. And then, so Vietnam was really the catalyst for a lot of, you know, for basically why we have PTSD today. And very quickly, in the 1970s, feminists working at that time very quickly found common cause with Vietnam veterans. And then burn victims at the same time. There were researchers that were advising the American Psychiatric Association and working on the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, that found similar symptoms in burn victims. And then people that examined earthquakes and floods found similar symptoms. So I was trying to look at those basically three or four traumatic stressors, which some people call the classic traumatic stressors. And you know, so ultimately that is, you know, for a lot of readers, that's kind of a disappointment because I wasn't able to encompass everything. But there was, that for me was a very deliberate, and I didn't read from that part of the book, but I explain why, you know, as an attempt to kind of get a greater coherence and more focus on a subject, I deliberately excluded some things from that circle in order to dig deeper into those things. And it's you know, every book that is written, and novels included, always kind of have a shadow book that was almost written that sort of haunts it, and that's sort of the shadow book for me. And you know, so there are, you know, it's never, books are really hard to encompass, you know, all of the different kinds of data that you can get to. So I hope that answers your question. Yes, ma'am.
I think you described several tours of duty. So why did you go back?
Well, I served to back up a little bit. My father served in the Vietnam era. I was in the Marine Corps there before 9/11, from 94 to 98. So I was in the infantry at Camp Pendleton, and deployed overseas. So I kind of had this, I had this infantry training background, and I had this interest, and I had read Mao and T.E. Lawrence, and Che Guevara, you know, as an undergraduate. So I had this sort of sense and this professional perception of what was going on in Iraq. And I was opposed to the war before it even began. And so I was, and as my old comrades went over and as, you know, our world seemingly went to war in 2003, I found it very hard to not go because I had a professional and a personal and a writerly interest in going and doing an assessment, a personal assessment of what was going on over there and writing about it. But I also had sort of a deeper, as I suggested in the first part I read from the book, I had a deeper, almost mystical sort of interest in what types of experiences, what you could learn about human nature by seeing it driven to its extreme. And war pushes our language, it pushes our ethics, it pushes our morals, it pushes our culture, it pushes our art, it pushes our technology to the extreme. And you can see, and that's easy to see today, just in terms of the technologies that we have that grew out of the Iraq War. I mean, the Iraq War was basically the nursery of drones. That's where all the drones which are set to change our airspace, those grew out of drones that were first used. The first handheld drone ever used in war was used by the Marines. It was called a Dragonfly, and I met some of the first people that used it, that employed it. So you see, so I was interested because that this is what happens. Television came out of World War II. Atomic power came out of World War II. Radar came out of World War II. All of the technologies that define our life today all are products of warfare, which is really unnerving when you think about it. But you always see the future. The future happens in war first, is my assessment. So there was always for me an enduring interest. And for me, with respect to like my particular symptoms, I prefer to sort of say it this way, like. And I've heard other survivors describe it this way. I don't like to think of myself as having PTSD. That's not an identity that I prefer to wear because it does have the disorder part of it, does sort of have the stigma to it, and I prefer to describe myself as having suffered from post-traumatic stress. And specifically, you know, I was in an ID attack, as I allude to in the first couple pages, and then which happened in 2007, and then in 2009, the first hint I had that not all was right upstairs was I was in a upstairs meeting here, was that I was in a movie theater watching an action movie. I was watching Iron Man, the first one, and there's a very realistically depicted IED ambush in the movie. And it's shot from the point of view that I was in the Humvee, usually in the rear left, and so they show it from right where I would have seen, and so that just really freaked me out, and I left the theater, you know, like my brain shut down like an overloaded electrical grid. So that was kind of like the first hint I had that I didn't have my memories totally under control, and over the course of the book I described that, and then some other symptoms that happened, and then how I sort of walk through, you know, how the VA works and my experiences with the different therapies, that the most popular therapies that the VA uses. So I had a New York Times op-ed on the 18th of January about that, kind of walks through some of these things, and prolonged exposure, which is one of the more controversial ones, which is one of the more controversial therapies. Yes, sir.
So I have a question around culture and how culture affects PTSD. So my thinking is that a soldier begins in a home culture, a war happens in a foreign culture, and then that soldier returns back to the first culture. So does culture affect when you look at patterns from around the world and other wars and other cultures? Is there any pattern that emerges, or is it?
The question is how does culture influence PTSD, and to what degree does culture influence PTSD? Is that correct? Not to narrate my resume, I had an article in The New Yorker that addresses this question fairly directly. But in a word, yes, culture plays a huge role in the development of PTSD, and really even if it exists in a culture. There are some cultures that essentially, and Russia is a good example, has very little interest in really paying much attention to PTSD, because it's just there. You know, the Russians are famously stoic, and I quote in the book this one Russian survivor of World War II saying, you know, what is the, you know, I have nightmares, but what is this post-traumatic distress? And they, you know, there are different cultures that have a very skeptical view of it. And specifically, the progression you just described of a soldier being trained and then going to a foreign country, serving, and then returning, that progression, if you think it through, that's a very American or a very Western progression, because that's not the case. For instance, like what do you say? And your question raises a lot of other questions for which there are very, very poor answers. For instance, what do you say to someone in Gaza Strip who is suffering from what we would call post-traumatic stress disorder? What do you say to someone in Algeria who has nightmares and hypervigilance? Because for them, it's TSD. There's no post there. I mean, Gaza is continually under rocket attack, as I understand it. So there's no, in terms of the idea of a survivor feeling alienated or sticking out or having some sense of liminality of being between worlds is very difficult to parse. And that's sort of one thing I get into the book, is that PTSD, and this is why it gets tricky, is that it is this very modern, very contemporary, almost suburban American phenomenon, because, and there's a very good reason for why PTSD was really recognized in the United States first and not in Israel or in the UK when there were equally good opportunities to do so. You know, after World War I, shell shock was, which is a much better name for the phenomenon, shell shock, the term, it just has this poetic resonance that PTSD simply does not. And yet the psychiatric establishment in the UK, steps were never taken to formalize shell shock, to institutionalize it as the United States has done. And that to me is really interesting, is that the history of World War I and the history and the poetry of shell shock are really, really powerful. It's that period produced some of the greatest war art and literature that the world's seen. And so the question kind of becomes, well, what role did the art play in that? Did the art almost serve as a medicine? Because the poetry of Shell Shock specifically, and I take the title of the book, The Evil Hours, is drawn from Siegfried Sassoon, who was one of the leading war poets. And so the question, in some ways, you have to wonder if the poetry was just so good and the literature that grew out of it was so good that it somehow, you know, absorbed and helped people process the emotions of the war. And so, you know, that, and there is a whole, one of the things I discovered is that I interviewed some researchers that are sort of stand outside the circle of PTSD and sort of are looking in and are very skeptical of it. And one researcher at Cal State Los Angeles, Gayathri Fernando, who is a Sri Lankan, she actually works in a field known as cross-cultural psychiatry that examines, like, for instance, she interviewed Sri Lankan tsunami survivors who have a radically different view of what PTSD is. And for them, and one thing I argue in the book is that trauma operates as both a birth, both as a death and a rebirth kind of experience. You know, what is gone, the old version of you is gone and a new one is reborn in the wake of trauma. And so that rebirth theme is sort of repeated in all of the literature and the poetry. And Gayathri Fernando, when she was interviewing this Hindi survivor, the Sri Lankan survivor of the tsunami, he was really psyched because he was like, dude, that is so cool that tsunami happened, because now my next life when I'm reborn again is I'm going to be like so much better off, because this survivor believed in reincarnation. So the ideas of how trauma is even interpreted on a really basic level, culture is a huge, huge underrated part of it. One more question. Yes, sir?
Well, I guess starting with a comment and then a question, but it strikes me that maybe part of what you're describing just now is maybe finding different ways of talking about something that's been a fairly common, consistent part of human experience, just finding a new language for it. It seems to recall what Foucault describes in the history of sexuality as what happens with sex, where we talk about what he calls an ars sexualis, which was the realm of poetry, it was the realm of pornography, it was the realm of dirty jokes and all these other ways of talking about sex, to what happens in the modern era when we scientificize it. But that also enables you to talk about all sorts of the different ways of being sexual, including things like queer experience. So it strikes me that that's, in a sense, what you're talking about is the movement of this thing from one discursive field
more
rational, scientific discursive field to a certain level. One other thing about Russians, as a Russian scholar, let me just say that the Russians deny a lot of stuff, including the existence of homosexuals, right?
Right.
So there is this sense in which, yes, that there's stoicism, if you want to call it that, but it's also a pathology in many cases. And so it's, but this finally gets me to my question. There is this sense that I think you do get into in the book about how this has been kind of exported out of American culture.
Yes.
So that now you do have people in Sri Lanka or somewhere surviving a tsunami that are being given some of these therapies, even
right,
regardless of whether there is a cultural appropriateness or something like that. Does that bother you?
The question is, does the exporting of PTSD bother me? It does. And there's a very good book called Crazy Like Us by Ethan Waters that explores, and I spoke with him, and it explores how all of the DSM, which is written by the American Psychiatric Association. It's an American document, but it's very popular. And the UN, in their international classification of diseases, you know, almost repeats almost all the DSM disorders. So PTSD was adopted by the UN in the 1980s. I forget the year. I think it was 91, actually. And so PTSD, which began, I mean, it really is still heavily associated with Vietnam veterans and American military veterans, but a good friend of mine, novelist Ismet Persich, who's in Portland, you know, he, you know, left Tuzla and was in Scotland working and was told he had PTSD and didn't, you know, and for him, the diagnosis is very relevant and it spoke to him and it's a part of, he's totally open and it speaks to his experience. So it does, in some ways, it exports, I think, in a very good way. And I think what's really interesting, if you step back and just sort of evaluate, okay, pluses and minuses, just to be totally simple about it, like, okay, pluses for why PTSD, the diagnosis, is a good thing globally. globally, it helps us connect with sufferers who are totally different than us and understand that, that it does, that tsunamis, that people feel long-term effects from warfare and natural disasters, and it helps us. And PTSD provides a common touchstone that we can explore very medicalized descriptions of suffering. And so that's a plus. I mean, the minus is that we export, and it's very difficult to, because the cross-cultural psychiatric work that's done is very, there's not a lot of money in it, basically. It's very difficult to do that kind of research because no one, you know, there aren't a lot of people lobbying on the part of Sri Lankans to have their particular flavor of suffering explored. But one of the minuses can be that we end up basically finding PTSD where we look for it. And so researchers, a Dutch researcher went to Algeria and looked for PTSD, and lo and behold, he found it because he asked, well, do you experience nightmares? You know, do you experience hypervigilance? And so there are sort of some basic research problems with finding PTSD in other places. And the Russians, you're in a far better position than I am to assess the Russian experience. But it's as a control for the U.S. experience, where therapy is very much a part of how we. That's how the FEMA spent millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, to send a surge of therapists into Lower Manhattan after 9/11. It's very much a part, and this was in the days afterwards. It's very much thought of as being a central tent pole in any, recovery operation. So that's we think of it in the American sense. It's very much a part of how we look at aftermath. Whereas, for instance, in Mexico, there was very recently a discharged U.S. Marine who was in jail in Mexico. His parents were complaining that he had PTSD and that he didn't entirely know what was going on and was very scared down there. The Mexican judge who was adjudicating the situation and trying to get it resolved with the U.S. State Department didn't acknowledge that PTSD was an issue, because Mexicans generally, their culture, which is strikingly violent in terms of the way violence is portrayed in their art and their literature, PTSD is not really as much a part of the conversation. So there was a very interesting contrast, just in a fairly direct way. So I don't know if that is most of the right. Right. I don't want to just Mexican culture. What I said is they have the Mexican imagination, I think, is different, because they tend to have the machismo, as you mentioned. They have a different relationship. I mean, American culture obviously is very gun centric and violent, but the Mexican imagination, I find, also have, there is a fascination with death and torture that is very different, but also can be unnerving if for an outsider. So anyway, thank you all very much for showing up on a Friday evening.
Thank you for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you value this episode or our series, please share your appreciation by posting a good review. It'll help more people find us. David J. Morris's new book is The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. The Elliott Bay Book Company presented this event on February 13th, 2015. Thanks again to Anna Tatashev for this recording. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.